Welcome, everyone. Welcome to our cast. This is your host, Ron Jacobs. I'm joined in the studios today by Rick Merrifield. And Rick, you are the Motion Strategy Director. What is that?
Motion's a code name of a methodology and set of tools that we've been working on here for a couple of years. Actually has its roots back about 7 years to some work that one of our corporate vice presidents, Norm Judah, drove that eventually led to the development of the Microsoft Business Solutions business, where we ended up with this map of a business that would be the target customer of the Microsoft Business Solutions software, where they overlaid some modules of software to inform our acquisition strategy to get a business software space. And we learned after that acquisition that as Norm Judah took this map around and shared it with people, they said, wow, that's really interesting and valuable. We've never seen anything like that. You should figure out a way to deliver that business architecture map to us, to your customers. And so it sort of bounced around for a number of years. Nothing came of it for a while. And then as Norm started to talk more and more about the map in the context of articulating the business value of a services-oriented architecture, more and more customers saw the value in helping the business side of the house in particular understand the business value of it. And so Norm asked me, as someone who's written some methodologies in the past and have built some tools more along the lines of business consulting than what Microsoft Consulting Services has done before. He said, why don't you go figure out what we can do to deliver these maps in a way that's interesting to Microsoft? So I built that set of tools and methodologies. We filed some patents around that definition of business architecture. And as part of the way to help people understand what it is, where things like process maps that a lot of people use as a representation of what the business does increasingly become out of date so quickly because the pace of business has changed and the business is always in motion these days. This view of a business that we provide actually is much more stable and can help inform not only decisions about process management but also technology decisions to support the business as that business increasingly is in motion. So that's where the name came from. It's still an incubation as a set of tools and methodologies, but we have been field testing it externally as a paid consulting service with customers for a couple of years, and we're just now getting ready to launch it on a more broad worldwide basis.
You know, that's really fascinating because Microsoft has typically been just a pure technology company. This has not been the kind of thing that we've done in the past. I remember seeing that big, huge module map up on a wall in this big poster size picture.
Yeah, it prints out 6 foot by 6 foot poster is how it prints out, and it's a really daunting and impressive image. And part of what people said initially was, oh, that's business consulting. Microsoft doesn't do that. Why would we do that? That goes against everything we represent. And it turns out that that's not the case. It's not as black and white as that. And it actually takes us to the first slide in terms of the problems that led to this. In addition to having something that people were asking for, there were some other specific problem spaces that we incorporated into getting funding for this and driving ahead with it. The first was that if you look at our customer satisfaction scores, what we call customer partner experience or CPE, there's a consistent pattern where customers have said to us that they would like us to do a better job of understanding their business and a better job of articulating the business value of our products to their specific needs. Nobody's really surprised to hear that statistic, that customers would like us to do a better job. And part of the challenge there is that because we're a technology company, we can't just all of a sudden overnight say, now we're business experts and now we get your business. But what we can do, and we did do in some analysis of that problem statement, was that just as nobody's surprised that Microsoft's not an expert in business, similarly, there are some more root cause problems in terms of communication between the business and the IT department that help fuel some of that problem. When business tries to articulate its requirements to IT, you've got a couple of problems. One, business people are really great at whatever it is they do, but they're not great at describing what they do to somebody else, much less somebody who's not an expert in their business. And so that creates a communication problem where it's difficult for them to really articulate what it is that they need in terms that this other person who doesn't really speak their language can understand. So then when you've already lost some of those requirements in translation, when that IT department then goes talk to vendors like ourselves, you've lost some of that requirements information in translation. It's harder for us, who are even more close to the technology, to connect to those business requirements. And so there's a sequence of problems that led to this problem. So we realized that to fix that specific problem, which was more of a symptom of another problem, if we could help improve the communication between business and IT, that would then help improve our ability to map the business value of our products to those customer needs. And that's really what we've done, and I'll get into some more of the specifics of that, but that's a big part of what we've accomplished with it. And having tested it now for a couple of years, we have really good examples and proof points across several industries of having done that.
You know, it seems to me that maybe the timing of why this is working well now has a lot to do with the big drive towards service-oriented architectures. And, you know, people weren't willing to look at service-oriented architecture in the same way that they looked at, you know, your typical departmental size IT project, because it was like an enterprise-wide shift or an investment, and it felt like an enormous risk, that and it was hard to assess whether there'd be any value realized out of that. So, you know, I've been a technologist my whole career. I was telling you earlier, I've spent my whole time working in ISV, so I've never really had to try to understand business architecture. You know, I just had somebody else did that work for me and said, this is what we've got to do. But so educate me a little bit on business architecture. I mean, what is business architecture really?
So we're very specific about what we mean by business architecture as a term that's become fairly common in the last couple of years that people throw around often in the same sentence with enterprise architecture. So in that vein, where we usually start in explaining what it is that we're talking about, we'll start with a process map so that people can be grounded with something that most people have seen or are familiar with, even whether they're on the business side of the house or in technology. And this is a very simple process map that was taken from an actual customer that does work in the insurance business, where they're creating a quote. And obviously stripped out any customer-specific information, but you see, just like any other process map, you see directionality, you see some references, there's a fax machine, there's some different shaped boxes that describe the work that gets done, there's another fax machine, and then it comes to an end. And so that, for a lot of people, if you ask a business person what they do, they'll give you an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper and say, this is what I do. It may have changed a little bit in the last 6 months, given the fluidity in business. There's a lot of that you'll see, that these process maps become what a lot of people will call dead documents very quickly because it's out of date so fast. And so the next slide highlights that there are some additional questions that are not answered by a process map. So looking at the top left, where does the arrow come from? What's the context to the rest of the business? Going down the layover on top of the fax machine, is sending fax really the requirement, or is that just some technology that's used to support or sustain some communication requirement? And how do you know whether or not somebody just flipped a coin and decided the fax machine would be the technology implementation of that communication requirement, or whether there's some actual constraint, either through compliance or governance rule or some other lowest common denominator factor that actually does have to be a fax? And that's not clear from this process map. In the middle of the page, is it stable? You don't really have any sense of what parts of this are stable or even which have changed most recently. Then going down, how is it measured? Who's the customer of this? Are there compliance needs? Is it core to the business? So some really basic information that are good questions about, you know, the metrics of it alone, or what are the key levers for whether this performs well or not. In terms of whether it's core to the business or not, is this a function that is why customers come to do business with this organization? Or is this a differentiator for this organization? Or is it a big part of where profitability comes from, so that you can really understand the importance of this function in some other larger context? And then the last point, where's the corporate boundary? It's entirely possible that some or all of this work has been outsourced to somebody or is performed by a supplier, or has more part of the function is actually performed by the customer. That is not explicitly visible in this map. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with this map, but there are certain important questions that are not addressed by a process map. And a lot of people have used process maps, barring having some other artifact, have used that to inform their requirements. And because some really important questions are not asked in a typical process map, that leads to part of that communication breakdown that I mentioned earlier in terms of business communicating with IT.
Okay, so the process map is good. It's a good start. It helps you get a general flow. But there's some missing elements, some
right.
important questions. What are those missing elements?
Well, so again, the process maps really became popular in the 90s and were a big improvement over what had really been the only way to build a view of a business in the past, which were financial data and org charts. And so by getting a process map, that was absolutely a big step forward and has exposed a lot of additional information. So they're still very valid and valuable. The things that they don't do that they weren't entirely intended to do. They're not a stable view of the organization, which is certainly becoming increasingly true. It's difficult, because of their lack of stability, it's difficult to stitch together a complete even view of a department, much less an entire business. And so the lack of context typically will limit the scope of a process map to an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. Lack of metrics, including how it's performing, how much it costs, how frequently you do the thing, how many people do the thing, are often not exposed in a process map. And that can be really informative in terms of the importance of a given process map. Lack of differentiation in terms of whether it's core or non-core to the performance of the business or to whether it differentiates the business. There's frequently a lack of awareness of the business boundary in terms of what's happening outside of that business boundary. To get a really clear understanding of what all the full flow of work that goes on. And it tends to be fairly subjective. And this gets back to why the business person isn't in the business of describing what they do. You ask them what they do and say, well, I have to send a fax to my customer. You say, well, that's how you do something today. Tell me what it is that you're doing. And in that case, it's a fairly simple example that they're communicating something to their customer. But you'll often get this how they do it today description encumbered with an actual description of what they do. And because they're talking to someone who's not an expert in their business, it can be really difficult to ask the right questions about how to separate those two things. And that's part of that fundamental problem. So then acknowledging some of those basic things that process maps were not intended to do, the pendulum swung the other way at the end of the 90s, and people started to look more to IT architecture maps to say, okay, we see that process maps don't do everything. Let's see what additional information we can get from an IT architecture map to maybe start to fill in some of these holes, which is valid, and we do get a lot of additional information from the IT architecture. What IT architecture often doesn't do is separation of practice from process, which is a way of saying the process map shows sort of the cookie cutter. This is the basic standard flow of work. In practice, a lot of people will have certain manual workarounds. They'll have exceptions that are not always reflected in that process map. Not always – the technology is not aware of some of those manual workarounds. And so it can be dangerous to deduce or suggest that you've got a complete set of requirements just from a combination of IT architecture and process. It's also unstable given particularly the amount of – that the process map will have to, in a lot of cases, be supported by the IT architecture. It shares some of that instability through association. It's not clearly connected to the business strategy in a lot of cases, and it's always risky to drive your business requirements from an IT-based view, which few people would dispute, and that last slide should be all capitals IT.
Okay. All right. So you have really a capability that you're describing in a process. So what is the capability that we're describing here?
So still back to that process map and attaching to that specific example of the fax machine. The fax machine is really the description of how they do something today. Clearly, if they were issuing insurance policies 40 years ago, they probably weren't using a fax machine, but they probably were fulfilling that requirement. And that requirement really is a communication of status, in this case to an agent. And the how they do it is separable from that what description that we call a business capability. And the how statement of how they do it today can be described in terms of whether it's automated or manual, insourced or outsourced, whether there's 6 procedural steps or 4 or 10 behind it, et cetera. Security issues, all those things are implementation decisions that can be separated from this articulation of what exactly the organization is doing in a specific step. Having said that, as I mentioned earlier, it's entirely possible that there's a legitimate business constraint that requires that they use a fax. But unless you until you separate this, what you're doing from how you do it, it can be difficult to document whether there is a constraint that it has to be a fax, or whether in fact somebody just flipped a coin and made that decision, so that it's not something that is really key to the performance of the business.
Okay, so this is an interesting way of thinking about the things that a business has to do in terms of capabilities. So what do we mean when we say a capability?
So as we've now said, a capability is not a description of how you do it. What is captured in a capability beyond just having a verb noun to say communicate status? There's a significant amount of additional information that we capture to define and articulate what's behind this description of what we're doing. So the metrics, how are we measuring it? How much does it cost to do the work? Service level is a term that we use very specifically. So very much like a service level agreement, if you outsource something, which is very familiar both to business people and IT people, if it's not outsourced, you should still have that same information, less formal, less contractual. We call a service level expectation attached to that block of work. and it has the same you have some performance data. You also have performance variation, threshold, notification data, some interface information. And some of that does get, in fact, to the implementation. But having a more concrete set of – a consistent set of service-level expectations attached to a block of work that has very clear service boundaries, if you will, around it, just like you have to have for a service-level agreement, is something that's very familiar and usable to both business people and IT people. And that's, in fact, a key connection point I'll speak to in a little bit, about how this is, in fact, an enabler of services-oriented architecture, where you take a word, the word service, in a way that's familiar to the business. When you talk about a service-level agreement, business people are very comfortable talking about a service-level expectation when they're not comfortable talking about a services-oriented architecture, even though this definition of a capability maps very cleanly and elegantly to the concept of a web service at an architectural level. Compliance and governance regulations, understanding whether it's environmental protection, Sarbanes-Oxley, internal rules and regulations, attaching those to the specific capability so you can understand additional cost and risk and benefit of making a change to the organization with some view and visibility into compliance information. Who owns it? Who's the customer of it? Does it or does it not directly relate to the performance of its parent? So there's a similar composition-decomposition framework for process that we have with capabilities. If I improve the performance of this communication of status 10 times, does that improve the performance of the overall create quote in this insurance example? Does that have any impact on the performance of that? And having the visibility into that performance information as well as performance of the organization overall. Is the capability a key part of what external organizations such as customers think of when they do business with this organization? Is this brand and identity kinds of information? And so forth. We actually have over 100 specific attributes that we can capture for a given capability along these same lines.
Okay. And really, when we're thinking about these capabilities, you kind of have evolved interesting ways of looking at them on the inside versus the outside. How does that work?
So one of the questions that we'll get is, as people start to say, okay, I kind of get this idea. You're saying if I separate what I do from how I do it, then the people and the process and technology are a statement of how I do it. If I do buy into this decomposition concept and that I can keep breaking down capabilities into sub-capabilities and so forth, just as I can break down process, as I get down to that bottom layer, is the capability inside of the process or is it a higher level of abstraction than the process? And so this slide, as a build slide, is a very good illustration where if you have the people taking procedural steps, and I think I can drive you out. So the person does a certain amount of work. That's reflected in a procedural step that is supported in some way or another or not by technology. All of those things are encapsulated inside of the boundaries of the definition of the capability. So you see on the outside of this cube, you've got communicate status and some very rudimentary information indicating metrics. So if I'm the customer of this capability, I don't really care what's going on inside of that cube. All I care about is that my service level expectations are being met or exceeded, and there's some additional information around interfaces and so forth. But one of the things that's important about this cube as a visual is to show that, or to illustrate that you can change people and process and technology infinitely without changing the capability itself. And so getting to the point of the fact that process and technology views tend to be relatively unstable, because you can keep changing those without actually changing the capability, it's a really valuable view to be able to build and aggregate this view of the business with this much more stable view of the business architecture, to use our language, business architecture being an aggregation of business capabilities that requires a lot less maintenance than the process maps and the IT architecture maps, that does enable you to really get a different lens on the work that's going on and how you make different decisions, whether they're based in technology or in the business.
So this, to me, almost looks like we've taken kind of traditional object-oriented the thinking and applied it to a business and said you ought to encapsulate details and you ought to have stable interfaces between objects and that sort of thing, right?
Yep. And so one of the and I'm the first to admit that I'm not a hardcore technology guy, but as it's been explained to me, one of the big differences between object-oriented and services-oriented architecture is that even within object-oriented, you still need to have some context data in terms of you can take away, say, the highest level parent in a tree structure of object-oriented and the lowest level child. But if you had in the middle of that stack, you have a third or second or third level dependency. You can't just take that object out and put it somewhere else. There's some forced context, parent-child contexting in that middle stack. That's something you can do with a services-oriented architecture. You can take this block of work and move it anywhere from a business architecture context, you could move it to the customer, to a partner, to a supplier, and it wouldn't need any other additional context to do its work. We talk a lot about the example of the self-service check-in at the airport that a lot of people have benefited from, where somebody, I think it was at Northwest Airlines a number of years ago, said, you know what, this is a function that's non-core to our business. We have to do it. Customer satisfaction is really low. Employee morale is really low. It's an expensive thing for us to do. What if we could move the function across the business boundary to have the customer do the work, check themselves in at whatever pace they want to do, whether they're at home or at the airport, go at their own pace, not have to deal with a condescending gate agent, have customer satisfaction go up, costs go down, employee morale go up for a non-differentiating function. And it's worked out really well, where they just moved this function across the business boundary to the customer, which in retrospect doesn't seem like such a big deal. But if you ask the question, why can't we have the customer do this work that we're doing today, that's a fairly radical change in a lot of contexts. But having that ability to ask the question, why can't we move this block of work somewhere else, from a boundary perspective, is a really powerful thing to do, both from a business perspective as well as from a technology perspective. And that's, to my understanding, one of the big benefits between service and differences between object-oriented and services-oriented.
Well, in fact, in the service-oriented architecture guidance that we've been issuing, for the last couple of years, we've been talking about the same sort of principles of encapsulating the details behind a well-defined service boundary, about having stable service boundaries, measurable service level expectations, for the exact same reasons, in that you could take an IT capability and move it around, replatform it if you needed to or whatever.
That's exactly right.
So, yeah, if you thought of your business in this way, it would map very cleanly to the service-oriented architecture.
Right, but the subtle, but and it seems trivial, but when you go into the business and start talking about the business about a services-oriented architecture, they're going to roll their eyes and hear nothing but technology. Whereas if you go in and start talking about service-level expectations as a derivative of the concept of a service-level agreement, they're with you, and they get it, and they understand the value of it, even though you're almost saying the exact same thing.
So let's get to the layers. What's in the layers?
The layers is a slightly different representation of the cube slide. And what's important about this layers view is that if you get to this, if you tease out this business architecture, expose the business architecture of an organization through this capability lens, and when we use the word expose, this is something that is already there in the business, and we're just asking a set of questions of the business to describe things a little differently, which does get to why it's credible for Microsoft as an organization to do this. We're not coming in as business experts saying you need to do this best practice or anything like that. We're just asking a structured set of questions to expose this layer that's already there with a different set of information than they're getting from some of these other layers. So in the case of I'll use an example I use frequently, which is pay employees is a very common capability in every business, and a description of what's supporting that thing from an IT architecture perspective, so application, information, and technology, the process, and the people doing the work. If you can get information about the capability in terms of how it's performing from a service level expectation perspective, you can begin to ask the questions about, does the performance directly or indirectly connect to the technology or the people or the process? So if you could contemplate a decision to change that capability, you can see where the disruption will occur. Often what happens when you go and sit down with a business user and say, well, I'm talking about changing your process because we're going to go ahead and deploy SAP or services or architecture or whatever, they say, no, you can't change my process. That's core to my business. That's really important. You're going to break everything if you change my process. That becomes a very so the business person takes that as a more personal attack. If you go in from the business architecture angle and say, okay, in the case of payroll, for most businesses, payroll is a non-core function. It does not directly correlate with organizational performance. And so in that context, amusing language, we'll say payroll is an example of a capability that most businesses don't care about. The ones they care about are the ones that tie to performance or brand. If you don't care about it, it still has to be there. It has to perform at a certain level. It has to be compliant, certainly in the case of payroll. But if you don't care about it, you really don't care that much about the technology behind it, who does it, or what process is there, as long as you don't degrade the performance, which is one reason a lot of organizations outsource payroll, because they don't care about it. It's non-core to their business. They don't care about that. That's a really simple example. Not every example is that simple. So if you can tease out each of these different layers and get more explicit about the extent to which you care about it, which is what an attribute that we'll capture in our model, and then understand the relationship between the performance related to IT and process and people, you can get to a much more structured, objective discussion with the business about what things can and can't change, as well as understanding where the performance levers are. So in a lot of cases, we'll have discussions where we will, in fact, focus on capabilities that customers don't care about. And so we don't care about it. What if we add some technology to this where we can either lower the cost of this function, which is really interesting, even though they don't care about it, taking cost out is always interesting to the business, or if we can change the level of skill set required to do this function, if we can add some automation, you may be able to use lower skills people and repurpose some of those resources that have a lot more business knowledge to something that's more valuable or more important to the business, which is also an interesting conversation. So that's the conversation we'll often have with the layers. And the layers is something that we do expose in a motion project, which we'll get to in a few slides.
Okay, so the end result of this whole exercise is that you end up with a map of the business?
Yeah, so again, to the earlier slide of the process map, we saw in the issuing of a policy, that 8.5 by 11 paper, the piece of paper, there was no context in terms of where that sat in the business. And so what this slide does in very simple terms, and our more comprehensive business architecture maps have a much more content, but this is just showing where that issue policy sits in an organizational map. And so we have, for our basic business architecture, five basic blocks: develop products and services, demand generation, fulfilling demand, planning and managing the business, and then the collaboration piece. So every business, excluding some public sector businesses, have these five basic functions. And this is just a simple drill down to four levels showing where that communicate status would sit in a basic business architecture. And then on the outside, it's surrounded by customers, partners, suppliers, regulatory bodies, financial services organizations, all of the bodies outside of the business that interact with that organization. So a couple of important things here. We talked earlier about the 6-foot by 6-foot module map that we have. So that map has over 1,100 specific capabilities like communicate status. So this is obviously a very simplified view of that. So we are able to drill down into seven levels of detail across a business architecture in seven industries now. We have industry templates that allows us to use as a starting point to ask questions about the capabilities that make up the business and help them begin to capture some of this content and expose the details around metrics, the capabilities they care about and don't care about. And we'll talk more about that as well later with some of the heat mapping tools that we've set up so that we can go in and IT can go into the business and ask some of these questions and get information without being an expert in their business, which is really one of the big success stories for us out of Motion.
So this high level just kind of gives us that context of the five basic demands, right?
Right. So this is just pulling up from that previous slide to say, you know, let's look at the high level, which is basically leading into the next slide to say, okay, if I understand what you mean basically in the simplest terms of what makes up a business architecture, if I work for a very large enterprise like Johnson & Johnson or Daimler Chrysler, how would I think about business architecture in those larger enterprises that are made up of so many different businesses? And so the Daimler Chrysler picture is, I have to say, I've not worked directly with Daimler Chrysler. I took all this content from their website, just picked a more globally friendly company that everybody's familiar with from a brand perspective. Daimler Chrysler is made up of four different business units: the Mercedes Car Group, Chrysler Commercial Vehicles, and Daimler Chrysler. And you see each of these has its own business architecture underneath the corporate the brand logo. So within Mercedes Car Group, you can see the three logos of Smart, Mercedes-Benz, and Maybach. So each of them is going to have their own business architectures as standalone businesses. And even in the case of Smart, you can get to the next slide. You see that there are three different businesses within the Smart organization: City Coupe, Roadster, and SUV. So each of those is going to have its own separate set of business capabilities, operate as a separate business capability list. How they implement those capabilities is going to be a different conversation. So it's entirely possible and likely that in the case of, say, human resources will be a set of capabilities in the plan and manage the business organization or part of the map. They probably have only implemented the human resources capabilities once across these three different lines of business, whereas they may implement some of the other capabilities individually by themselves. And so that implementation decision, if you see that is in fact the same capability with the same requirements across multiple business units, an organization can decide that they only want to implement the capability once rather than having it multiple times. Microsoft is an organization has in fact done that. Across all the different business units, we've deployed human resources one time, whereas from an IT perspective, we've actually broken up some of the IT functions across the different business units. So there are different business unit IT groups. So we've implemented IT for each different instance that we have a business unit. In some cases, for things like infrastructure and messaging, they're implemented once. But to keep with the discussion of describing what you're doing as opposed to how you're doing it, the what always stands out for each business unit. How you do it, you may do the same how across multiple business units, and that's a business decision that whether it's the same people or processes or technology, you can have this discussion of should it be the same implementation? Are they serving the same customers? Does it benefit from using the same technology or best practice process? They can have that conversation more objectively.
Okay, so I'm beginning to get this, and it's really exciting because it's like light bulbs, light bulbs are going off in my head as I imagine, you know, I can see so many parallels between the ways we've been describing service-oriented architecture and thinking about a business this way, because this is a very simple way of thinking about the business architecture. I don't have to have an MBA to understand this.
Right, that's been the big aha for the Microsoft community is that this is a way for us to engage with the business to present and deliver a new view of the business that they don't already have. And it's been a point of frustration for the business people that if you go and ask them questions about their process and say, geez, I just described that 6 months ago. Do I have to describe that again? This is giving them something they've not seen before that's valuable to them, that's also accessible to the Microsoft community, where we can just go in and ask these structured questions about what it is that they're doing and give them information that actually helps them better scorecard and manage some of their own business decisions in addition to helping IT better support and attach to the service level expectation from a business perspective. The other thing that's sort of accidentally beneficial is that by having this clear service boundary on the business capability, oftentimes what we're seeing now is that the business will come in and say, well, I want this window to do this and I want this specific technology, and the business will overstep their bounds by trying to make the implementation decision. And now IT can push back and say, you know what, I've got your service level expectation for your business requirement. It's my job to decide how to implement this from a technology perspective. And it may, in fact, be relevant in some cases for the business user to drive some of the technology decisions. But this boundary is beneficial for both sides of the house in that IT can push back and say, it's my job to make the implementation decision. It's my job to support the service level expectation as you have defined it for us. But now I'm going to go make this decision so that I can support your needs as described.
Well, and there's some real power in sort of bridging that communication gap and defining the clear lines of responsibility.
Sure.